From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Renewed protests in Hong Kong over the weekend. We begin with this report from Press TV.
Police have engaged in fresh clashes with anti-election law protesters in Hong Kong while trying to clear the protest site. Protesters were planning to surround the government headquarters when police tried to disperse them by pepper spray. The defiant crowd, however, refused to leave the site. Meanwhile, another group of demonstrators tried to occupy a main road connecting the east and west of the island, but police thwarted their efforts. Dozens of protesters were arrested and there were several injuries on both sides. It's been over 2 months since the beginning of the demonstrations. The protesters were opposed to an election law introduced by the Chinese government. Joining us now is William Jones, political commentator, and he joins us via Skype from Leesburg. Mr. Jones, thank you for joining us here on Press TV. Now, the situation in Hong Kong is that of a stalemate, so to speak. The government is sticking to its plans while the protesters are still on the streets. Where is this headed, specifically considering the foreign interests that are involved here?
Well, it's really still to be determined. I mean, I wouldn't call it a stalemate. I think there's been something of an escalation in terms of the demonstrators that the police, it seems to me, for months now, have been very even-handed. There have been attempts to try and get some kind of a dialogue. But there's a basic bottom line here that doesn't seem to be accepted by the demonstrators, is that Hong Kong now is a part of China, and that therefore there are similar restrictions on how Hong Kong's going to be governed, because it isn't totally independent. Now, it never was that, in fact, not under the British at all. But in this case, I think there's been a lot of outside interference from both our old British friends who used to have Hong Kong, as well as from the side of the United States, in a variety of ways to encourage the demonstrators and to push them on, or to provide a window where they think that they will get this international support. That's why I think the thing has been, the ante has been upped over the last few days, when it looked as if it was going to lead to a demise of the demonstrations.
When the British and the American governments do decide to interfere when it comes to Hong Kong, isn't that realization stark in their minds that the Chinese government is not going to negotiate if they see a foreign hand at play?
That's absolutely the case. However, the growth of China, the rise of China, as it's called, although it has the official line is that it's supported both by the U.S. and by the British, they are very concerned about it. They would like to weaken China. They would like to divide it. They would like to cause all kinds of trouble. And Hong Kong, which of course was in the British sphere of influence for so many years, a lot of friends there, a lot of contacts, a lot of things that can be done, whether it can't be done in other parts of China. This is now becoming something of a weak link, and I think they're trying to press that weak link to at least weaken China, to cause trouble. You see that particularly with the moves being made in the U.S. Congress and in the British Parliament to give statements of support, criticism of the Hong Kong government. This is quite openly at this point, and what's going on in the ground is anybody's guess.
A delegation of British parliamentarians was refused entry into Hong Kong by Chinese officials as they attempted to investigate the situation in the city. A spokesperson for the Chinese Foreign Ministry, Hua Chunying, said China has the right to decide who it lets into Hong Kong.
Hong Kong is China's special administrative region. Beijing is in charge of Hong Kong's foreign affairs. China has said many times to Britain that it is resolutely opposed to so-called delegation of British Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee going to Hong Kong for so-called investigation, and asked them to cancel the visit. If certain British members of Parliament are determined to do this, which is open confrontation, it's not beneficial for Sino-British ties. Our door is always open to those who want better Sino-British relations. But we firmly oppose and won't allow anyone to interfere in China's internal affairs.
Protests continued Monday in Mexico. We have this report from Telesur.
Protests in Mexico have not ceased since the abduction of 43 students from training to become royal teachers. Many agree the students disappeared at the hands of local police authorities. Massive protests are planned for today in Mexico City and across the country. Today marks President Enrique Peña Nieto's second year in office. Yesterday, Argentine founder and leader of the human rights group Grandmothers of Plaza de Mayo, Estela de Carlotto, met in Mexico City with parents of the missing Ayotzinapa students to express her support. Last week, authorities confirmed that 31 other students were also abducted in Guerrero a few months before the Ayotzinapa students.
In Mexico City, thousands marched from the main square to the Angel of Independence, one of the city's most famous monuments. Demonstrations were also held outside several embassies and the Mexican Stock Exchange, as well as on highways and at toll booths across the country. And here in the U.S., protests continued across the country over the holiday weekend and into Monday over the grand jury's decision last week to not indict Darren Wilson, the white Ferguson, Missouri cop, for shooting and killing unarmed black teenager Mike Brown in August. There were protests underway across the country Monday, including a large one here in New York, with thousands marching from Union Square to Times Square in Manhattan. On Thanksgiving, protesters showed up at the Macy's Thanksgiving Parade. There were 7 arrests. On Sunday, protesters shut down I-395 in Washington, D.C. for the 3rd consecutive day. As the mobilization around the country continues to intensify, many, both among the protesters and in the media, are asking what the next step will be. President Obama was conferring Monday with representatives of civil rights groups and law enforcement after an announcement that he would seek funding to provide up to 50,000 body cameras for police. We have this commentary from imprisoned journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Ferguson's fallout, protests in over 170 cities, demonstrations during dozens of Black Friday sales with demands to not spend Black America's money on mindless materialism while millions mourn. The police killing of teenaged Mike Brown and the subsequent whitewash by a prosecutor's state grand jury has touched a raw nerve among young Black America. The question is, what next? Already, media and government are trying to manage this event by its calls for closure, and hence that relief may lie with federal officials. Most know that these are but pipe dreams. Soft words meant to ease back into a deadly status quo of business as usual. But any system that kills children is a system that can't be allowed to exist. With tens, perhaps hundreds of thousands, if not millions, in a state of outrage, now is the time to organize them into organizations designed and committed to fight for deep structural social change. The system that allows its agents to kill children with utter impunity must be shattered, and new humanistic structures, ones controlled by the people, must be erected in its place. This energy, this moment, must not be allowed to dissipate. It must be seized. It must be harnessed. It must be used to build new ways of being in the world. This will take will. It will take vision. But most of all, it'll take commitment to fight and struggle until social change becomes a reality. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
We'll have more on the situation in the aftermath of the Ferguson grand jury decision later in this newscast. A pipeline project that would have carried Russian natural gas to the heart of Europe has apparently fallen victim to soured relations between Russia and the EU. Russia's President Vladimir Putin said that his country has been forced to withdraw from the South Stream pipeline project due to obstruction by the EU, and that gas flows will instead be directed to other customers. He spoke to the press after talks with Turkish President Erdogan.
Well, as far as South Stream is concerned, we believe that the European Commission's attitude has been has not been constructive. It has not been helpful in implementing this project. Moreover, we actually see it trying to create impediments and obstruct the implementation of this project. Well, if Europe does not want this project to be implemented, then we will not implement this project. We will redirect our energy resources to other regions of the world, in part through implementing our liquefied natural gas projects and speeding them up. We will just sell our energy resources to other markets, and Europe will not receive them in the necessary amounts.
South Stream was a planned gas pipeline that would transport Russian natural gas through the Black Sea to Bulgaria and through Serbia, Hungary, and Slovenia to Central Europe, terminating in Austria. Meanwhile, Russia's economic minister, Alexei Ulyakiev, said that his country plans to start delivering grain and industrial products to Iran in return for oil. We have this report from Press TV.
The Russian minister says Iran wants to start making payments between the two countries in their national currencies and that preparatory work has already begun. The Russian economy minister has visited Iran, where he held talks with his Iranian counterpart, Ali Tayebnia. The two officials discussed ways to improve trade ties between Tehran and Moscow.
Taking into consideration that Iran and Russia have been targeted by Western sanctions, the two countries have prepared grounds to meet their requirements through trade exchanges and joint ventures. The visit of the Russian Minister of Economic Development to Tehran is part of efforts to implement agreements reached previously. Today, we agreed that deals to enhance cooperation on customs and foreign investment will be signed as soon as possible. We also agreed to form a committee which will work to enhance investments.
This past Thursday, United American Indians of New England organized a National Day of Mourning observance in Plymouth, Massachusetts at noon. National Day of Mourning began in 1970 when a Wampanoag man, Wamsutta Frank James, was asked to speak at a Massachusetts state dinner celebrating the 350th anniversary of the Pilgrim Landing. He accepted. Then there were problems. This was Moonanam James from the United American Indians of New England at Plymouth, Mass. This past Thursday.
When asked by the organizers of the dinner to provide an advanced copy of the speech he planned to deliver, Wamsutta agreed. And within days, he was told his words were not acceptable. The planners of the gathering, fearing the truth, told him he could speak only if he were willing to speak false words in praise of the white men. The organizers were even willing to write a speech for him. After all, they said, the theme of the celebration is brotherhood, and anything inflammatory would be out of place. He refused to have words put in his mouth. National Day of Mourning came into being as a result of his refusal to speak untrue words. Instead of speaking at the banquet, he and many hundreds of Native people from all the Americas gathered in Plymouth on this hill and observed the first National Day of Mourning. Now, what was it that got all these people upset? One that he used as a basis for his remarks, one of their own history books, Mort's Relation, which was a pilgrim account of their first year on Indian land. What really happened at the first Thanksgiving, or as some of us call it, the first Thanks-taking, according to popular myth, the Indians, that's us, and the pilgrims, that's them, sat down and had a wonderful dinner. Everyone lived happily ever after, the end. Many times we have been asked, what is the true history of Thanksgiving? This comes as no surprise. The truth has been buried for 395 years. In 2020, Plymouth is planning to celebrate 400 years of the same myth. And I don't think anyone from UAIN, or that's United American Indians of New England, is going to be invited to address that banquet. And if we are, rest assured that no advance copy of our remarks will be sent. But here is the truth. The first Thanksgiving did not take place in 1621 when the pilgrim survivors of the first winter sat down to dinner with their Indian friends. The first official National Day of Mourning, or first official Thanksgiving, excuse me, feasting in Massachusetts was proclaimed by Governor Winthrop and the Massachusetts Bay Colony. in 1637. He did this to give thanks for the safe return of the men from the colony who had gone to what is now Mystic, Connecticut, to participate in the massacre of over 700 men, women, and children of the Pequot Nation. About the only true thing is that these pitiful European strangers would not have survived their first several years in New England, were it not for the aid of the Wampanoag people. What native people got in return for this help was genocide, the theft of our lands, and never-ending repression. Another truth. The reason that the mythmakers prefer to talk about the Pilgrims and not the earlier English-speaking colony in Jamestown is that in Jamestown, the circumstances were so ugly to hold up as an effective national myth. For example, the white settlers in Jamestown turned to cannibalism to survive. Not a very nice story to tell your kids in school. And the Pilgrims did not find an empty land any more than Columbus discovered anything. Every inch of this land is Indian land. The Pilgrims, who did not even call themselves Pilgrims, did not come here seeking religious freedom. They already had that in Holland. They came here as part of a commercial venture. The Mayflower Compact was nothing more than a bunch of white men. Women were pretty excluded by them, sticking together to ensure that they would get a return on their investment. They introduced sexism, racism, and a class system to these shores. And guess what? They did not even land at the sacred shrine down the hill called Plymouth Rock, which is a monument to racism and oppression, which we are proud to say we buried not once but twice in 1970 and again in 1995. Upon arriving, the Pilgrims opened my ancestors' graves and took as much as they could carry of our corn and bean supplies. Massasoit, the great sachem of the Wampanoag, knew of this, yet he and his people welcomed and befriended the settlers, saving them from extinction, little knowing how many Wampanoag and other Indians would be killed by their guns or dead from their diseases. Later, from the very harbor that we can see here, the pious Pilgrims sold my ancestors as slaves for 220 shillings each. Some would ask what we have gained by observing National Day of Mourning since 1970. The very fact that you are here is perhaps our greatest gain. People from the four directions, having seen through the Pilgrim myth, join us every year in the struggle to destroy that mythology. And there are two plaques erected by Plymouth, one on Coles Hill to honor National Day of Mourning, and another in Post Office Square honoring Metacom or King Philip. This was part of the agreement we signed with Plymouth in 1998. Those of us who were here in 1997 will never forget what happened to our peaceful march that year, when 25 of us were arrested. But after a powerful show of unity, demanding all charges be dropped, Plymouth was forced to drop the charges and erect the plaques. All right. Another thing I want to add, now there are at least two rocks in Plymouth that speak the truth. The placement of these plaques does not end the need for us to continue to come to Plymouth and speak the truth. We will do so as long as sports teams and schools continue to use racist team names and mascots. We will continue to gather on this hill until the U.S. military and corporations stop polluting our mother, the earth. We will continue to stand here and protest until racism is made illegal. We will not stop until the oppression of our two-spirited sisters and brothers is a thing of the past. We will continue to come here and protest when homelessness is a thing of the past, when immigrants from Mexico, Central and South America are no longer targeted, when no person goes hungry or is left to die because they have little or no access to quality health care, and when union busting is a thing of the past. Until then, the struggle will continue. Now, that first National Day of Mourning in 1970 was a powerful demonstration of Native unity. Today is a powerful demonstration of not only Native unity, but the unity of all people who want the truth to be told and want to see an end to the oppressive system brought to these shores by the pilgrim invaders. Yeah. Now, sadly, the conditions which prevailed in Indian country in 1970 still prevail today. In 1970, we demanded an end to the Bureau of Indian Affairs. It is still a demand today. Native nations do not need federal oversight to govern themselves. And those who started National Day of Mourning spoke of terrible racism and poverty. We all know that racism is alive and well. Not only Native people, but many people from the four directions are mired in the deepest poverty, while the 1% reap huge profits. Every winter, millions of people have to make a bitter choice between heating or eating. Native youth suicide and school dropout rates, our rates of alcoholism continue to be the highest in the nation. As we did in 1970, we mourn the loss of millions of our ancestors and the devastation of our beautiful land, water, and air. We pray for our people who have died during this past year and during the past 522 years since Columbus showed up. I hope that you will join me in grieving too for our sisters and brothers in all countries, human beings who are referred to by this government as collateral damage. Keep in mind that for centuries, people throughout the Americas have been the collateral damage of the European invasion. I also hope you will join me in grieving too for the immense suffering of our sisters and brothers in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, in Palestine, in Iraq, all human beings who suffer and face acts of terror on a daily basis. And remember too the millions of people, the hundreds of millions of people who are hungry today, no matter where they live. We condemn all acts of violence and terrorism perpetrated by all governments and organizations against innocent civilians worldwide. Since the invasion of Columbus and the rest of the Europeans, Native people have been virtually non-stop victims of terrorism. The slaughter of the Pequots and Mystic in 1637, the U.S. military massacres of peaceful Native people at Wounded Knee and Sand Creek, and so many, many other places. The very foundations of this powerful and wealthy country are the theft of our lands and the slaughter of Native peoples and the kidnapping and enslavement of our African sisters and brothers. Today, on liberated territory, we will correct some history and do so in a country that continues to glorify butchers such as Christopher Columbus, in a country that glorifies slave-owning presidents such as Washington and Jefferson, and even carves their faces into the sacred hills, the Black Hills of the Lakota. Now, on our program today will only be Native speakers. This is one day when we speak for ourselves without non-Native people, the so-called experts, intervening to interpret and speak for us. We ask that our non-Native allies respect Native leadership today. Now, our very presence frees this land from the lies of the history books, the profiteers, and the myth makers. We will remember and honor all of our ancestors in struggle who went before us. We will speak truth to power. We will remember in particular all of our sisters and brothers, including Leonard Peltier and Mumia Abu Jamal and Oscar Lopez Rivera, who are caged in the iron houses. In 1970, very few people would have given any thought to the fact that the indigenous people of this hemisphere do not look upon the arrival of the European invaders as a reason to give thanks. Today, many thousands stand with us in spirit as we commemorate our 45th National Day of Mourning. And to our beautiful Native youth, this is what I say. Learn about and remember what your ancestors went through to bring you here. We are like the dirt, we are like the sand, and we are like the tides. We shall endure. Now, in the spirit of Crazy Horse, in the spirit of Metacom, and in the spirit of Geronimo, we are not vanishing. We are not conquered. We are as strong as ever.
President Obama was conferring Monday with representatives of civil rights groups and law enforcement after an announcement that he would seek funding to provide up to 50,000 body cameras for police. According to the New York Times, the video footage from these cameras could help clarify disputed incidents like the deadly encounter between Michael Brown and Officer Darren Wilson. The president announced that he would tighten standards on the provision and use of military-style equipment by local police departments, stopping short, however, of curtailing the transfer of such hardware or weapons to local authorities. According to the Times, after a review of the government's decade-old policy of outfitting local police with surplus military equipment, the White House concluded that the vast majority of these transfers strengthened local policing, but that the government should impose consistent standards in the types of hardware it offers, better training in how to use it, and more thorough oversight. Ryan Becker is the chair of the Answer Coalition. He was in D.C. this weekend and spoke with Eugene Puryear of the Party for Socialism and Liberation.
As we see right now, people are in the streets all over the country. Was this a surprise?
Well, from my perspective, it wasn't a surprise. We know in the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement report, the every 28 hours Operation Ghetto Storm, that only 4% of the officers that they found who had killed someone in 2012 in their report, only 4% of them actually faced any charges. And so impunity really is the order of the day when it comes to police killing. So it's an unfortunate situation, but not a surprising one.
I mean, just in the recent days, in the last week, we have seen more police killings in Cleveland. There was the killing of Tamir Rice, a 12-year-old boy, on a playground. There was the killing of a 28-year-old, Aki Gurley, in his own apartment building just after he walked into a stairwell by Brooklyn police. This comes on the heels of so much attention in the media to the issue of police murder. The police, the government, must know that they're sitting on a possible volcano. Why do they do nothing to show that the police don't have impunity? Why not accountability?
Well, I think for them, accountability is dangerous. I think the impunity of the police is exactly where their power is. Certainly the police, who are a repressive apparatus, I mean, I always say to people, what is it that stops a homeless person from going into an empty hotel room or house to live? It's the police. And to have this kind of repressive apparatus be effective, it has to have the impunity to kill and to get away with it, whereby people in the streets fear the police because they feel like, well, even if I don't do something wrong, I can still get killed and no one will be held accountable. It makes them have a certain presence, a certain reality about what the police force means, which is ultimately what makes them effective to the powers that be, that this repressive apparatus is feared and that it's not held accountable, which will keep people who even are quote-unquote law-abiding in check.
Well, let's just follow up on that theme. I mean, the United States government, the capitalist ruling class, their narrative is that the United States is the most prosperous country in the world, the most stable country in the world, that has peaceful transitions from one administration to another, that there is the sort of mitigation of class divisions, or somehow that the country is, you know, unlike the class-divided countries of old Europe or the rest of the world in the Middle East or Asia. But when you compare, say, just basic statistics, like in the U.K., one of the more important, bigger capitalist countries in Europe, they had a few people get killed last year by the police, just a few, and yet you're saying that in every 3 days, probably more people are killed by the police than in an entire year in the UK. I mean, is the United States such a powder keg that, you know, is there such a subterranean sort of ready-to-erupt class struggle that the U.S., powers that be have to rely on this kind of terror, say, compared to Europe?
I think so, absolutely, because of two issues. I mean, one, there is a huge amount of dissatisfaction in the country. I mean, if you look at the approval ratings of Congress, of the president, I mean, people are completely alienated from the political system. The two major parties essentially discount out of hand any number of issues, any number of real remedies, and sort of tell people you have to be willing to compromise away the things that are most dear to you, the things that are most important to you, and accept that the political system doesn't work in a way that can really really meet your needs. And so in the United States, you have really only a very limited political outlook that perhaps in times of relative stability is able to channel people's anger. But in situations like this, where there's so much just pent-up reality and so much anger, then I think you see a situation whereby, as it's been said before, one spark can start a prairie fire.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.